Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We are reading in Book 1, Canto 5, The Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. And we reached the top of page 90. We're almost at the end of the canto. We have read about how, as a result of the secret knowledge, which we read about in Canto 4, King Aswapati has conceived a will and a hope immense. He has recognized the possibility of a divine life on earth. And that's what he wants to make happen. Those glories that he's glimpsed in his yogic experience, he wants these to become normal on earth, for earth and men. And as a result of that aspiration, very, very intense upward movement, a great descent has come down into him and transformed his whole nature. And as a result of that, he's become aware of a secret nature that's not the ordinary earth nature. It's not the divine nature, it's a nature which rules the borderline between the material world and the subtle worlds. And the power which is ruling that border region, she can be quite a dangerous power, but she surrenders all her powers and capacities to the spiritual will of Aswapati. He sees that this realm which she is ruling, which she offers to him, is like an entrance into God's thousandfold house. All the worlds in the universal manifestation, not only this material plane, but all the subtle worlds. And that this border sovereign, she's drawing her powers from all these different realms, higher and lower, all the ones in between. And as a result of what he sees there, he also sees that there's an order in all these worlds. A giant order was discovered there. And he sees that it's kind like a stairway or a ladder by which it's possible to move from the lowest rung to the highest, and from the highest to the lowest. Each rung is a world, a level of involution and of evolution. So this forms like a golden ladder tying with diamond threads the spirit's extremes, the highest levels and the lowest. And then he sees a last high world where all the worlds meet. That's where the light began of the Trinity Supreme, Satchit Ananda. That's a world where everything gets harmonized. Everything discovers there what it's blindly seeking for here. And that last high world allows the finite to move into the boundless state, to rise into its own eternities. So we read up to the first line on page 90. The last sentence reads, "The inconscient found its heart of consciousness, the idea and feeling groping in ignorance at last clutched passionately the body of truth. The music, born in matter's silences, plucked nude out of the ineffable's fathomlessness, the meaning it had held but could not voice, the perfect rhythm, now only sometimes dreamed, an answer brought to the torn earth's hungry need, rending the night that had concealed the unknown, giving to her her lost, forgotten soul. This is the truth world, the supermind. So we'll read on from there. Tara, would you read? Thank you.
Can I ask a question back on the, just the previous
bit? Yes, yes, please,
so
Paula.
On the question, the sentence, the last sentence at the top, 565, giving to her her lost, forgotten soul. So that giving is being done by?
This perfect rhythm. It's as if there's a music, and when everything is in the right rhythm and harmony, then it brings an answer to the need of the earth, and it destroys, it rends the night that had concealed the unknown, so that the earth discovers her lost, forgotten soul. We will give you books. You have books? This is the soul of the earth. In fact, that's what this world does, this last high world where all worlds meet. It reveals to each of their the levels their truth and their unity. That's what comes in the next line, this grand solution. Everything gets solved. This grand solution there in that last high world closed the long impasse. An impasse is a street that's blocked. You can't go through, you can only turn back. So, but when they reach the end of the street or the end of the ladder, the solution to everything is there. But for the moment, that's a kind of impasse to all our mortal efforts. There's a point beyond which we cannot go. But this gets solved in that last high world. Is it okay, Paula?
Could I ask something more about that? What comes to me is that harmony or harmonization is the thing that brings
the solution.
The solution rends the night. That harmony is not what we think of as harmony. We can't mentally. But we can try, I mean, here on this plane, for harmony, for somehow it's just an idea that comes to me.
Well, we can try to catch this harmony, this true harmony, which is really at the heart of everything. No?
It's here already.
Yes.
Perhaps it sounds like a terribly dumb question, but what is harmony? What is harmonizing?
It's as if each of us is a note of music, or as if each of us is playing an instrument, no? And we are just playing away on our own, and we're not listening to the others, and we're not listening to any inner voice. So what we've got is a big muddle, a big mess. But if we became aware of some supreme conductor who was indicating from within to each of us exactly what note we were to play on our instrument and how to do it, then everything would become a harmony, no? Or we would see, we would become aware of the harmony that's potential and inherent in everything in this material universe. For that we need this reconciling wisdom. We need that higher, we need to become in touch with or in contact with that higher wisdom that can look on life, and that it takes the striving undertones, these struggling lower notes of mind, and it gets hold of the confused refrain of human hopes. Our human hopes are always repeating and repeating, but in a very muddled way. Why is it like this? It shouldn't be like this. It has to be much better than this. And each of us has some sense of what that much better is. No? But it's all very confused. So it takes that and it mingles them in a sweet and happy call, a call of aspiration. And it lifts them. It lifts up from this underground of pain, which is underneath everything that we experience here in the material world. It lifted up this inarticulate murmur of our lives. There's even an inarticulate murmur going on in matter, he tells us elsewhere in the poem. No, there's a murmuring and a mutter, and it's a kind of complaint, but it's also a longing for something. I want it to be different. So it lifts up that complaint, that muttering from the underground of pain, and shows it that it has a wonderful meaning, an illimitable sense, a meaning and a significance. It's not just murmuring and complaining and muddle, no. It all has a meaning, and that meaning gets revealed by this, the consciousness of this truth world. A mighty oneness is its perpetual theme. It keeps insisting, oneness, oneness, no. And that oneness catches hold of the faint utterances of the soul. The soul, it may be giving us messages, but it comes to us so faintly through all the thick layers, we can hardly hear them. No? But that theme of oneness catches hold of these faint, scattered utterances, which we can hardly read, we can hardly understand, because our consciousness is made up of these rigid lines of thought. We can't read between the lines and catch what the soul is telling, because we are here in the midst of this kind of half sleep, this drowse, this coma of consciousness on matter's breast. So whatever divine messages come to us, they come in a very faint and confused way, like disjointed mutterings in sleep. But that reconciling wisdom joins all these things. It groups and connects all the golden links that these disjointed mutterings have lost, and showed to them their divine unity. And in this way, it saves from this error of divided self, which dominates our consciousness, where we see everything separately and in opposition. The deep spiritual cry in all that is. There's one deep spiritual cry that's going on all the time in all the disjointed, scattering utterances, not only in this world, but in all the other worlds. It needs that reconciling wisdom to see all that and connect them and show that it's actually all part of one divine harmony. He said, like a scale of organ notes, you know, from the deepest to the highest, getting louder and louder and louder, this divine music. I suppose this is what we should be listening for if we want harmony. Shall we go on?
Do you know the piece of music called The Lost Chord?
Sir Arthur Sullivan, yes. Yeah, so he caught that music for a minute, but then he could never find it again. Anyway, we will find it. We are destined to find it. Yes.
Just like he had the question, what is harmony?
Yeah.
What does harmony look like? What does unity look like?
Well, again, we can take a musical image, no? When everybody in the orchestra is playing perfectly some wonderful piece of music by Mahler, for instance, they are a unity. And I once, in the Royal Festival Hall, had an amazing experience listening to a big orchestra with singers playing Mahler with that wonderful Dutch conductor. What is his name? Anyway, it doesn't matter. The name of the conductor doesn't matter. But at the end, when it was finished, everybody burst into rapturous applause. And I couldn't move. I couldn't clap or anything. But what I could do, the marvelous experience I had, I experienced the Lord. The Lord in each of those people, thousands of people in that hall, all the musicians who'd been playing and the conductor and all of us who were enjoying the music, and in each and every one of us, the Lord was enjoying this wonderful occasion in a different way. Each person was having their own experiences, but this, the presence of the Lord, brought it all together and enjoyed it all. And actually, I suppose that's what's happening all the time. We go on, we are living our lives, and we have our ups and downs and our good moments and our not so good moments. But within us, the soul is enjoying all that. And the Lord is enjoying all the souls. So when I went out of the concert hall, I suddenly realized why we have cities. It's really nice for the Lord to travel on the underground and be packed among all those people and feel what all of them are feeling, no? I mean, that's just a very personal digression, but you asked me, what does unity look like? So unity looks like that to me, the oneness of all the multiplicity. And that's the raison d'être of this manifestation. Otherwise, why did he leave his unity? We read about it recently, no? Why did he lay on the spirit the burden of the flesh? It was so that the seed of divine existence could be spread and blossom in what had been mindless space. That's why he left his white infinity, where everything was anyway perfect.
When our own vision is splintered, we see not unity, we see chaos.
Right.
We see disunity. I remember once an ecologist saying, most people go in the forest and they say there is no law. It's a jungle, but to an ecologist, it is full of
harmony. Yeah, full of harmony.
Full of harmony.
The forest is one marvelous organism made up of so many different... That's why the forest is actually such a good image for life. No?
We live in pure harmony and symbiosis.
Sorry?
We live in symbiosis, you know, in harmony.
Yes, right. And if you take away one tiny species of fungus, actually the whole ecosystem suffers, no? So we human beings are only just beginning to understand that. And we can understand it maybe mentally a little bit, but it should become our living experience.
And it looks like human beings are more part of that symbiosis for now.
That we are what?
It looks like human beings are not part of that symbiosis.
We feel as if we are separate. That's exactly the error of mind. Yes? We feel separate. And we feel that what we do is artificial compared with what nature does. In nature, of course, she's red in tooth and claw, but still we are perceiving that there's a kind of harmony in all that she does. But we are also children of nature. Who and what is expressing itself through us? It's the Supreme Divine Mother in her play. Yes, Margaret, what did you want?
Most people on earth experience the oneness of the nature of the forest. Many people, you go for release in the nature and then immediately you receive this oneness. So there's also, of course, the towns of the separation, but no towns built also up parks and everything. You have this experience. I think it is quite...
Well, if you concentrate on a flower, you can get some kind of identification. But most of the time, we feel separate. We feel separate from each other, and we feel separate from what's going on.
We damage nature also. We damage the nature.
Yes.
Suddenly.
Yes.
You're destroying
it. Man is destroying. Ignorant man can destroy.
So that's the consciousness which is supposed to be realized here in Oroville. No? If we can experience the oneness, we can live the oneness, and then we'll be able to do things right.
I think the more we become awake inside, the more we feel harmony with the universe.
Well, we have to contact the one within ourselves. It's the only way. We can't do it artificially outside. Yes?
There's the element of desire, selfish desire, which is working against all the beauty of understanding the oneness.
We have to recognize that that's a kind of immature striving towards the oneness. That's what it is.
But we may destroy ourselves and are striving for the oneness by those who are full of desire.
Well, don't blame those who are full of desire. Who isn't? Who isn't? No? We are all full of it. We're all at this level. No? But we are assured, we are promised that all this is going to work it out. At the moment, this very inexperienced orchestra, everybody's just learning their own little instrument. No? But if we all keep at it and learn to play our own little instrument with all its complications as well as we can, and we are aware that all the others are in the same process, so we don't blame anybody. We don't say, oh, it would all be fine if it weren't for you, you know, which we do all the time. If we didn't do that, if we just saw that we're all in this same process. And the mother has said, she said, it's kindergarten stage.
No?
Kindergarten stage. Here we are all running about in the playground and bashing each other or being nice to each other sometimes too. But it's all very much in the process of evolution. And I've recently been working with Book 2, Canto 4, which is about the kingdoms of the little life. And in the sections of that canto, Sri Aurobindo describes the emergence of the very first life forms from matter. And they are such ugly little things. Well, they make slimes and yeasts and molds, and they look like next to nothing. And he says, it seemed hardly the worth the effort to become or to exist. But Asvapati sees that this is just a first stage of a very important development. And then Sri Aurobindo shows these small single-celled animals. There's a new consciousness that comes, and they're more complex animals and even gigantic dinosaurs. And then eventually there are even creatures in a human form, but they don't have a human consciousness. They only have an animal consciousness that's entirely fixed on the surface and just what's the events that are going on round about. That's all the animals really are aware of, except some need. And that's precisely these needs which are going to grow us into divine beings eventually. But for the moment, it takes the form of longings and frustrations and annoyances and disappointments and bewilderment. But we have to believe, and I can really very strongly feel it, that every human being is carrying within them this sense of what should be. It's just we don't know how to bring this symphony together yet. No? Yes, Anandi.
I think that we have to be humble. And in page 100, Shravinda say, this faint and fluid sketch of soul called
man.
We are there, but we can go somewhere else, I'm sure.
Yes, that's the promise. That's what we're here for, is to learn to play this symphony. And for now, Aswapati is seeing that there's a hierarchy of worlds, and each of those worlds represents a step of soul development.
You know those microorganisms?
Yes.
Talking about the fungus, the protozoa, those are all present within our human.
Yeah, we are carrying them around with us.
Many more so than your human cells. And so when we have this way of speaking, which is not very accurate, in the yoga people who talk about that, they talk about your cellular transformation. And I'm sort of curious, well, what about all those millions and millions and millions of cells that are not human, but that have been with the evolution and the life within biology of the planet? So that those smallest pieces are within us and they get transferred generation by generation for as far back as we can see.
Yes.
And the dangers that we're encountering now have to do with what's happening to the what's called the microbiome. The human microbiome is being destroyed by many things and things that occur within our day-to-day function as human beings using antibiotics, interfering with the natural processes of the human body.
And we don't seem to be able to control or stop this. Mm. This is our problem. No.
It's very difficult to change these
these patterns.
Directions.
Yeah. Yes. So, but also if we look at the history of evolution, we shouldn't stray too far, but this is a little bit what Shobindo was talking about. It has been the great disasters that have brought out the big leaps forward. For millions, 350 million years or something like that, there were only these little protozoa. But then something terrible has happened to the Earth. I don't know what exactly it was. But when it was over, suddenly there were complex creatures, the next stage which he describes in the canto. And there seem to have been several of those, and each of them has in a way been a terrifying destruction, but it has enabled a step forward. I don't want to be too optimistic about this, but I think we've been made a promise, and the people who've made us that promise are absolutely reliable. So we should keep it in mind. Yes, Don. Sorry?
Is there time for
text? Well, we should go on with the text, but anyway, say what you have.
Those of you who read the Oronet, yesterday there was an incredible picture of a dead dragonfly being carried away cooperatively by a large group of ants. Some of you may have seen it in the number of that. Yeah. So this idea of cooperation, working together and doing things, it's not only a human.
No, it's much more in ants. Much more in ants and termites.
Did you see it?
I didn't see it, Don, no, but I take...
I have a copy of it. Anybody wants a call, come to the house. It's yesterday's oral.
But we can think of ourselves as protozoa as cells of the universe, no? But through this process of evolution, we've reached a stage where Schrobindo regards it as a very, very important stage. We have reached the level of a certain degree of choice, of understanding and the possibility of making a choice. Our will is not absolutely free, as we can see with all the difficulties in changing things in the world. And those primitive little creatures are still scrabbling about inside us and influencing the way we feel and act. But there is the possibility we can become aware of higher powers and higher influences, and that we are here for a purpose, and that if we really aspire to take part in achieving that purpose, we'll receive all the help we need. We can't hear you, Anandi.
Mind can come into the body. I tell you, it's an answer for that, because the cells that they are consciousness, they get together and they make another being from there.
Mm.
I mean, the cells are in evolution, of course, working, no?
Yeah.
And she says, like, the other cells know, but the ones that they are already in consciousness, they can make another being.
Mm.
We don't need men and women for that. Their own body makes another one, and after they pass away. And the experience is fantastic. It's March 69. I think that we have an answer there.
Mm.
For me, it's very powerful. Yeah.
The answer is this last high world.
Yeah.
This superman consciousness,
yeah,
Mother spoke of in 1969.
Yeah. Yeah.
Supramental consciousness is beyond that.
Yeah.
She said these... like this consciousness she experienced, this is the transitional species. But that is, the supramental descent has happened. So all these higher forces are at work in every particle of matter and in every cell of all our bodies. So I think it is just a choice that has to be made. Do we want to be a conscious part of that fulfillment?
Mm.
Yes.
Slowly.
Things will happen. Yes. Right. So, shall we read on? Yes. What comes next? Yes. Who's next? Ton.
She's the checking. Perhaps the Dutch conductor was Bernard Haitink.
No, it was not.
Sweden?
It was. I feel as if his name begins with O. He was a friend of Mahler.
Bruno Walter.
Yes, it was not Bruno Walter either.
But he's German.
Yeah.
It'll come to me after we've all parted. But anyway, he's a very, very great, wonderful conductor. Sorry, I always have this difficulty with his name.
All the great words that toiled to express the one were lifted into an absoluteness of light, an ever-burning and the immortality of the eternal voice. There was no world more or truth with truth, the endless chapter of their differences, retold in light by an omniscient scribe, traveled through difference towards unity, minds winding search, lost every tinge of doubt, led to its end by an all-seeing the initial and original thought with the finality of an ultimate phrase. United were time's creative mood and tense to the style and syntax of identity.
Thank you. All the great words, the great spiritual messages and gospels that have toiled to express the one in that world, in that truth-conscious world, they were all lifted up into an absoluteness of light and ever-burning revelations of fire and the immortality of the eternal voice. All these great messages are, in their way, revelations. They are all revered as the word of God, but it's only when they are lifted up to that highest level of truth that they really achieve their fullness. No? And then there's no quarrel anymore between one expression of truth and another. The endless chapter of their differences, which has dogged human history, when it's retold in light by an all-knowing scribe in the truth world, it's seen that they have been traveling through difference towards unity, just as all of us are, in fact. So then the winding search of mind lost every tinge, every trace of doubt, because it's been led to its end, to this grand solution, by an all-seeing speech, a speech that is expressive of absolute consciousness. When in my early days in Oroville, it was so wonderful that if there was a doubt or a discussion, we could ask Mother. And I noticed that's what she did. She would just see all the aspects of the problem, and with this all-seeing speech, she would give a simple reply that everybody just had to accept. It was so obvious, so simple, so powerful. Of course, this is on a different level. This is on a universal level. And he says that on this universal level, that all-seeing speech, these are difficult lines, garbed the initial and original thought with the finality of an ultimate phrase. United were time's creative mood and tense to the style and syntax of identity. These are words and terms that have to do with speech, with language, with words. Originally, there's a thought, a conception, and for that thought or conception to be expressed and realized, made real in actuality, there are many, many stages to be passed through. But this all-seeing speech is able to unite all these. It clothes the initial and original thought with the finality of an ultimate phrase. It simply puts it into the inevitable words. And in this speech, the creative mood and tense of time. In time, there is movement. One word comes after another. The order in which we put the words in a sentence makes a difference to the expression. And verbs, action words, they have moods. There's past, present, and future, but there's also subjunctive and conjunctive and optative and various different moods. And there are other tenses, of course, past, present, and future tense. So these are things that are existing in time, in the unfolding manifestation. But this all-seeing speech connects all this to the style and syntax of identity. Syntax is the way in which we arrange the words in a sentence to show their connections. No? There are many different possibilities in grammar, but all of them, that is their purpose, to show the relationship of the words in the most expressive way. And a great writer or orator will use that syntax, that way, a grammatical way of arranging words in a particular style. We are enjoying Sri Aurobindo's unique style in poetry and in prose. No? But he's speaking here about the style and syntax. Style and syntax are the product of a consciousness. No? So this is a consciousness of oneness, of identity. All these things get expressed in that all-seeing speech.
Hello.
Mm.
Does this mean that if we have the same style and syntax in speech, that there is unity?
I don't think it has to be like that, no. That's a kind of mental solution, you know, that if we all use the grammar correctly, we will understand each other better. To a certain extent, of course, it's true, yeah? But only to a very limited extent. Actually, if we can recognize the oneness between us, the words we use to express will express oneness, whatever order we put them in, I think. I think Sri Aurobindo is using this image here to show the all-inclusiveness of this consciousness and the way in which it can be expressed. And now he's going to speak about it being expressed in music. Helmut, would you read?
A paean swept from the lost music.
Thank you. A paean is a song of triumph and praise. Strophe is like a verse, no?
Loosely, a stanza.
A stanza, yeah.
More accurately, half of a pair of songs sung by the chorus in ancient Greek plays, as it moves to one side, its counterpart being the antistrophe struck up as the chorus returns.
So you can imagine the Greek drama. They have only a very few characters, main characters, and much of the narration and the comment comes from a group of actors or singers who are the chorus. And at some points in the drama, it may happen that the chorus divides itself into two, and one half sings the strophe, or chants the strophe, and the other half responds with the antistrophe. So these are different ways of commenting on or of expressing the narration that's going on. Okay? I think we have to, and together they make up an ode. We have to read these lines in conjunction with some lines on the previous page, on page 89, which is, it starts at line 541. It's just one sentence, I want to read it. Sri Aurobindo describes all this hierarchy of worlds, which you can mount up and down. He says it's like an organ scale of the eternal's acts, mounting to their climax in an endless calm, paces of the many-visaged wonderful, predestined stadia of the evolving way, measures of the stature of the growing soul, They interpreted existence to itself and mediating twixt the heights and deeps, united the veiled, married opposites and linked creation to the ineffable. He describes this series of worlds as an organ scale. You know, an organist with all the stops out and using hands and feet, playing all the notes from the bottom to the top. Marvelous. Mother wished to have an organ here in Oroville. I don't know when her wish will be fulfilled. It's as if each note represents some act of the eternal. No? And they are mounting up to their climax, getting louder and louder, but the climax is an endless calm. So each of these worlds is a pace, a step up of the many-visaged wonderful, the wonderful who puts on all these different faces. Predestined stadia. Stadia is a way of measuring distance. So one by one, the soul has to pass through these stadia, these steps, these paces, as the way evolves. They are measures of the stature of the growing soul. You start right at the bottom, very little, and get bigger and as you grow. So all together, these paces are interpreting existence to itself as we become aware of this universe and these steps. We begin to understand where we are and what is going on. And they mediate, they connect the heights and the deeps. They unite the veiled, married opposites of spirit and matter, of soul and nature. They link creation to the ineffable, the inexpressible presence that is the Creator. So now that organ scale, he's expressing it in another way as this paean, this song of triumph. Paean swelled, it comes up from the lost musing deeps of the inconscient. It's an anthem pealing out. It's very loud and powerful and beautiful. It's pealing out in praise to the triune ecstasies, the three in one. We can again think of Satchitananda. And what is happening is a cry of the moments, a wonderful expression coming from the moments of time, and it's crying out to the bliss of the immortal. So this hierarchy of climbing harmonies. And first one comes and then another, the strophes of a cosmic ode, a hierarchy of climbing harmonies. Each world is a harmony, and each world is peopled with voices and with visages, with faces, and they're all aspiring in this crescendo of the gods, getting louder and louder and louder, more and more powerful from the abysses, the deepest immeasurable depths of matter to the peaks of the spirit. Yes, Lyupa. I can't hear you very. Please, can you share it? Yes.
It can add to some.
Yes, please.
Love is a keynote. Joy is a music. Power, it is the spring. Knowledge is a performance. The infinite all, the composer and audience. We know only the preliminary discourse, which are as fierce as the harmony shall be great.
Yes.
But we shall arrive surely at the few of the divine beatitudes.
Yes. Wonderful. That's it, exactly.
Thoughts and aphorisms.
Thoughts and
beliefs. Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
What's the meaning of the word fugue?
A fugue. A fugue is when you take a simple theme, the composer takes a simple theme, and then he develops it in many different voices. And each, we can follow each of the voices, but the fugue as a whole is harmonizing all the different voices. And the, yes, right. So shall we go to the end? Yes. I think Helmut read about the immortals' changeless seats. Yes. Yes.
The line, there was no world more of truth and truth.
In our world, truths are always quarreling, no? We have to develop the city, but also we have to care about ecology and, you know, that we see many truths. And each of us maybe clings to one particular favorite truth and keeps insisting on that one. But in the truth-conscious world, there's no quarrel between these truths. There's no more fighting about my truth is the best, or this is the truth, or that is the truth. Here it wouldn't matter, no? These are all many truths. But they are all united in the truth consciousness. There's a wonderful passage about that at the end of book 2, canto 12, I think. If you want to have a look on page 282. 282. This is the end of the heavens of the ideal. But perhaps instead of that... Or as well, we can go to page 276 first. The last sentence on page 476. Page 276. Page 276. It's talking about truth. It says, neither thought nor word can seize eternal truth. In our thinking's close and narrow lamp-lit house, the vanity of our shut mortal mind dreams that the chains of thought have made her ours. But only we play with our own brilliant bonds, tying her down, it is ourselves we tie. And he goes on to say that it's even like this with the seer and the sage. Because still the human consciousness is limiting the divine. To know truth really, out of our thoughts, we must leap up to sight, breathe her divine, illimitable air, her simple, vast supremacy confess, dare to surrender to her absolute. I'm going to the bottom. For truth is wider, greater than her forms. 1,000 icons they have made of her, and find in her the idols they adore, but she remains herself and infinite.
This line 584 supports the vision I just had of that this quarrel of truth with truth is like if you had triangle. So the two truths are the bottom two, but there's a higher one that makes the other point at the top. So he says, out of our thoughts when we leap up to sight. There's always something that will harmonize.
Right, yes. And
that's an easy way to remember that.
And that's a very good way to deal with an impasse. If we come to a point where it seems absolutely blocked, can't go any further. We have to move to another dimension. I think that's what Einstein said. You can't solve a problem on the same level where it is. So each of those impasses, those complete blockages and irreconcilable puzzles are an opportunity to rise to a higher truth, reconciling truth, reconciling wisdom.
It's only the people who don't want harmony that can't find one.
Well, everybody does, actually. And anyway, now let's go back to our text on page 90, 91. I think we'd better finish where we are. Shouldn't let me digress too much.
It was a great digression. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's worth reading this again. Above were the immortals, changeless seats. Above this, this hierarchy of climbing harmonies. Above were the immortals, changeless seats. White chambers of dalliance with eternity. Dalliance actually means flirting. So it hasn't yet reached eternity, but it's communicating with, playing with, making love to, and the stupendous gates of the alone. So we can say this is the topmost level of the manifestation. And above that, across the unfolding of the seas of self, appeared the deathless countries of the One. A many-miracled consciousness unrolled vast aim and process and unfettered norms, a larger nature's great familiar road. This is what Asvapati is perceiving and seeing. Above the supermind, right at the very top, he gets a view of a larger nature's great familiar roads. And there, affranchised, set free from the net of earthly sense, Sri Aurobindo often refers to our senses as nets for catching insects or birds or whatever. We are catching sense impressions, but set free from any net of earthly sense. Calm continents of potency were glimpsed, vast realms of power, homelands of beauty shut to human eyes, beauty that we can't see. He sees them half seen at first through wonder's gleaming lids, as if his eyes are half closed, dazzled, surprised the vision with felicity. Sun belts of knowledge, moon belts of delight, stretched out in an ecstasy of widenesses beyond our indigent corporeal range, the range that we can experience with our bodies. There he could enter. Svapati can enter those realms. He can stay there for a while. There a while abide. A voyager upon uncharted routes, fronting the viewless danger of the unknown, adventuring across enormous realms, he broke into another space and time. So he becomes the traveler of the worlds, and his journey is described in the next book, the book of the traveler of the worlds. He's seen the hierarchy of worlds, and now he's able to enter in to that realm and begin to explore them. And he starts from the bottom and explores all the way to the top in book two. So perhaps we can listen to Mother reading some passages from these last two sections.
Magic forth her entry glimmering, quivered in a pinnacle, a screamed like a chord of the mystical traffic of the world.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.